Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to talk about beer brewing yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 213.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 213, and it's late April 2020. Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to talk about beer brewing yeast. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and of course, the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control with perfect repeatability. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. You can order yours today from BlickmanEngineering.com. For more information, again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Charlie specializes in the study of wholesomeness in beer, including beer perception, polyphenols, foam stability, oxidation, and flavor stability. Charlie, it's great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure. It's nice to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
So how are you doing? Last time I talked to you, I think you were just getting ready to retire from the University of California at Davis, although I understand that you're not quite fully retired now.
No. I retired from the day job at the university in December of 2018. But I'm still involved in what we used to call extension. These days it's called continuing and professional education. So I'm still doing those classes, including online. And, of course, since January of 2019, I've been the senior quality advisor for Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, which I'm very proud to be associated with. So, yeah, right now, as we're in the midst of the coronavirus episode, I'm doing a lot of online teaching. All the extension is done online these days now.
And, so are you still teaching some of the courses at UC Davis? Or?
Yeah, I am. As I say, these are the ones for the, not for the campus students, but for those people who are involved in continuing professional education. So there's the Master Brewer Certificate and some shorter courses. There's a whole series on quality that you can dial into on the various aspects of quality. So I'm doing that, but also I'm training a lot of people within the Sierra Nevada organization on the sales staff and so on as well. So I'm having fun.
Yeah. You mentioned you were doing something with Sierra Nevada just a few minutes ago, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was happy hour.
Happy hour.
So they
virtual happy hour or what?
Virtual happy hour. And this was with we're actually doing some work with the sales force on in the west and also in the east, and so that they had a happy hour today at 4 o'clock Eastern time, and we have a few quizzes and so on. It's good fun. So it's amazing what you can achieve. But so I'm doing all that. I've also there's a new book just come out. It's called In Praise of Beer,
Oh, nice.
Which is largely focused on the consumer, on the drinker, rather than the sort of the technical people. And also recorded one of the great courses. So you see these advertised in the newspaper, you know, all these courses on art and literature and religion and so on. And I did the one on beer.
And we really? Who was that with?
That's with Great Courses. That's called the Great Courses. And they have a studio in, I believe, not too far from you in Virginia, in Alexandria. Mm-hmm. And so we recorded half of it there, and then we recorded the other half at the Mills River Brewery of Sierra Nevada, and which, of course, is the most spectacular location on the planet of a brewery. I mean, it's just fantastic. If your listeners have never been to the Sierra Nevada Brewery at Mills River, they're really missing something. It's just fantastic. So I made the mistake of looking at the reviews. People either love it or they accuse me of selling us being a salesman for a single brewing company. But you know, it is a great location. So.
Well, pretty much no matter what you put out, people are going to put positive and negative comments. So you know.
Oh, they are. They are, and it's best to just smile. You know.
I mean, yeah. Most schools, you can rate your professors now too, right?
Yeah, I didn't used to look at those. Oh, well, actually, I did. I compared a former student of mine with me, and my ratings for teaching were far better than his. But my God, he got red chili peppers all over the place for being hot. I didn't get red chili peppers.
Well, we're glad you're safe up there in California and doing well. Today, we're going to talk about yeast, I think, right? Let's start with just the basics. What's the difference between, say, lager yeast, ale yeast, and then maybe something we know like bread yeast?
Yeah, I mean, ale yeast is the Latin name is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and you can actually isolate ale yeast all over the world. You know, it's alive and kicking in nature, and it is a yeast that often is referred to as top fermenting yeast because, given its druthers, it will rise to the top of a fermenter, and can be collected, skimmed off the top of the fermenter, and it's quite happy at reasonably warm temperatures. So our ale fermentations are often at reasonably warm temperatures. Mm-hmm. Lager yeast is a strange beast. People have called it various things over the years. It's been called Saccharomyces carlsbergensis. It's been called Saccharomyces uvarum. It's been called Saccharomyces cerevisiae lager type. These days, the taxonomists call it Saccharomyces pastorianus. And it's unusual in that it's not... you can't get it out of nature. It's not isolable in nature. The lager yeast doesn't exist in the wild. It arose not too long ago, really, in the scheme of things, probably a very few hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. And it arose, people say, somewhere probably in a brewery in, I don't know, Germany or somewhere, when an ale yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, sort of parted with a wine yeast called Saccharomyces eubionus, and the two melded together to form Saccharomyces pastorianus. So it's actually got 50% more genetic material than ale yeast, which means it can do some things that ale yeast can't do. It is more temperature sensitive, so it prefers lower temperatures, and it's so-called bottom fermenting yeast because it tends to settle to the bottom of fermenters. Now, of course, if you got one of these modern cylindrical vessels, one of these very big, tall fermenters that hold thousands of barrels or liters of fermenting wort, then the yeast is going south, no matter whether it's an ale yeast or a lager yeast. But that is the fundamental difference between ale and lager yeast. And you mentioned Brettanomyces. That the history of that is fascinating.
I was mentioning bread yeast. I'm sorry. Bread yeast is what I said. Yeah.
We'll get back to the other one later on. Well, bread yeast is also Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And so most of the yeast that are involved in most of the Saccharomyces that are involved in different foods and drinks are Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I'll tell you a story. I won't name the brewer, but there was a meeting of yeast professors. Most of the professors in the world of brewing across the world, their specialty is yeast. Uh-huh. I've done a lot of work on yeast, but I wouldn't put it as my favorite topic. But nonetheless, so all of my friends and colleagues that we had a meeting, and the local brewer invited us to go to visit the brewery, and he very graciously met up with the party, and he said, "Welcome to my little brewery." He said, "It's by now, I hope you've tasted my beer. You can see that my beer is all about the malt and the hops. In fact, I just think yeast is a vehicle for making some alcohol and carbon dioxide. In fact, I think so much about it. I get it from the local baker."
Interesting.
I think he was joking. But I can't guarantee that, you know. So the reality is, you know, bread yeast will make alcohol, but of course... But two things: bread yeast, when it's doing its job, is not doing it for very long. And the second thing, of course, is any alcohol that is produced is going to be belted up the away in the oven. So, but yeah, bread yeast is Saccharomyces cerevisiae too.
Interesting. Yeah, I think Chris White did a study. You probably read it, some of the work. Chris White with some other folks that did a study on the DNA of some of these things and actually traced them back. And I think they all trace back to, you know, two major branches, if I recall. Probably what you're... Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And in terms of the lager yeast, there aren't that many strains for sure. And, you know, a friend of mine, Greg Casey, who... variously over the years was with Anheuser-Busch and with Stroh and with Coors and various others, and I think a yeast company actually. He would talk eloquently about so-called Tuborg yeast and Carlsberg yeast, two different types of yeast. And then, of course, there's actually a yeast called Sartz yeast, just like there's a Sartz hop, S-A-A-Z, there's a Sartz yeast as well. But in terms of lager yeast, there are nowhere near as many permutations as there are ale yeasts.
And you mentioned lager yeast isn't natural, so I assume it was human cultivated, I guess, for beer brewing, or what? What happened? Well, it just evolved over time?
Yeah, I don't think anybody deliberately did it. I don't think anybody sort of put them in a bedroom together and dimmed the lights and played soft music. Yeah. I think it just it came about somehow. I don't know, Brad. I wasn't there.
I was wondering if maybe it was just cultivated over the, you know, as lagers started to become popular, that, you know, yeah, the sure sort of self-selected or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there's I'm very confident there is a that played into it.
Now, yeast itself is a single cell organism, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeast is it's a fungus. It's a single cell fungus. So it's about 10 millionths of a meter in diameter. So you need a pretty powerful microscope to really look at the detail on a yeast cell. And of course, it's actually often Saccharomyces is often used as a sort of the model organism for human studies, because it, you know, it's a eukaryotic cell. So in terms of the fact that it's got little organelles inside it, just like a human cell has, so there's a lot of similarities in many ways. So when people are talking about, you know, studying DNA or studying mitochondria and all these things, then yeast makes for a pretty good model. But of course, the yeast grows, multiplies. You've got to have yeast growth if you're going to have an efficient fermentation, and it grows by budding. So a little daughter cell will appear and will progressively grow till it basically is the same sort of size as the mother cell, and then they will divide, and now you've got two yeast cells, and then you've got four yeast cells, and then eight yeast cells. So it grows exponentially, and it's, you know, during that growth that it's metabolizing the carbohydrate, and of course it can do it in two ways. And that, again, is a difference between brewing yeast and ale and bread yeast. What you're interested in for when you've got brewing yeast is you're interested in making beer. When you're interested in baker's yeast, you're interested in making the
bread.
Yeast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it can make the bread. Now, if yeast is growing and in the presence of a lot of sugar, like it is when it's fermenting wort, that sugar basically turns off the pathway by which the yeast respires. So a yeast cell can respire, just like you and I respire.
Yeah, I think it has two different cycles, right? Respiration and what's the other one? I'm sorry.
Fermentation,
of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So if the yeast ferments, what it's doing is reacting the sugar with oxygen, just like you or I would, and makes carbon dioxide and water.
Mm-hmm.
But if the yeast is presented with a lot of sugar, lots and lots of sugar, it doesn't need to go to the trouble of making all the complicated machinery to respire. What it does is just simply make alcohol and carbon dioxide. Well, it's not totally simple, but it's a lot more simple than respiration.
Mm-hmm.
So the high levels of sugar turn off the mechanism for respiring, and so the yeast makes alcohol and carbon dioxide. Now, if you are wanting to make baker's yeast,
mm-hmm.
the way that it's done in a yeast factory is to feed the yeast with small amounts of sugar continually. So the sugar concentration is kept very, very low, and you give the yeast a lot of oxygen, so it actually starts to respire. It doesn't ferment, it respires. And when it does that, it makes a lot more yeast cells. So that's how you maximize the yield of baker's yeast if you're in the business of making baker's yeast. But of course, brewers are in the business of making beer, not more yeast. They do make more yeast, but nowhere near as much as they would do if the yeast was respiring.
Yeah, and I had Chris White on just a few weeks ago talking about how he makes yeast for beer.
Right.
And of course, two big things that came out was one that, you know, it's got to be super sterile because the requirement for sterility and everything else is much higher with beer than, say, making bread.
Right.
And then the other thing I think he mentioned was, he produces it obviously by creating sterile wort. And
right.
then actually that's how he grows the yeast up from a small sample all the way up, much like we would with a starter, I guess, right?
Well, that's right. And that's what, in the larger brewing companies, every so often they will replace the yeast. They will come up with a new batch, and they will start with basically a very few cells from a master culture, and then they'll progressively grow it up in larger and larger quantities until finally they go to the propagator, and they'll produce hopefully enough yeast for the first fermentation. Actually, a lot of times brewers talk about that very first fermentation with newly propagated yeast as being, the word they use is aberrant. It's not typical. And I suspect that one of the reasons may be, in some instances, that the yield of yeast is a little bit less than perfect, not quite as much as you would ideally want to pitch that fermentation.
Hmm.
But There is one brewer that I know very well that uses newly propagated yeast every time. He never transfers yeast from one fermentation to another fermentation. He uses newly propagated yeast every time.
Wow.
So different people have different ideas. And of course, in my native England, there's people who have been transferring yeast from fermentation to fermentation for years now.
For hundreds of years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about yeast strains. What impact do yeast strains have on the beer flavor? And are there certain yeast strains obviously suited for different styles?
Yeah, it's fascinating business, all this. And I as I say, my buddies, most of them are yeast people. I'm the guy who teases them, and I'm fond of saying, well, you know. Like the guy said earlier on, I think it's a great way of making alcohol and carbon dioxide, but whatever. And I don't really mean that. Obviously, the yeast strain can have significant importance. and it produces a whole raft of different flavors. The reality is that most yeasts produce pretty much the same range of flavors. So they'll make alcohols and esters and VDKs and sulfur-containing substances and so on. Although they will produce them in different quantities, of course, mm-hmm. and so a different balance of those things. There are some yeast strains, of course, which are producing some specific substances. Perhaps the best example is the Hefeweizen yeast, which is an ale yeast. It's a Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast, but of course it has got an extra gene in it for an enzyme called ferulic acid decarboxylase. And so this is an enzyme which takes something called ferulic acid, which comes from the grain, mm-hmm. and it takes away the carbon dioxide, so it's a decarboxylase, and it makes something called 4-vinyl guaiacol, 4-VG, and that smells of clove. So that is the source of the clovey flavor. Now, there are many wild yeasts, things like Saccharomyces diastaticus, that also produce this clove-like character. So the bottom line is, if you've got a Hefeweizen that doesn't have the clove, chances are you're not using an authentic Hefeweizen yeast. Alternatively, if you've got a beer that shouldn't smell of clove and you've got clove in there, you've got a wild yeast contamination. Mm. And now this is a good example also of how there is an interplay between the wort and the yeast. So I'm very fond of saying that I personally believe that any variation in the composition of the wort, depending on how it's produced, and also the fermentation conditions of temperature, oxygen supply, fermentation shape, et cetera, those are at least as important as the yeast strain. And when it comes to Hefeweizen, you've got to give that yeast ferulic acid. It's got to have the substrate to convert into the clove flavor. Mm-hmm. And that ferulic acid comes from the cell walls of the grain. And there's an enzyme that brings it into the wort. And that enzyme is very sensitive to heat. So you've got to, if you really want to make a Hefeweizen with a good clovey flavor, you've got to mash in at a lower temperature than the conversion temperature. So as I think people know, I invariably talk about degrees Celsius. Your listeners will have to work it out for themselves. But 45, 50 degrees Celsius is a sort of temperature where over a period of about 20 minutes, you will release the ferulic acid. The yeast will then be able to use. So the importance of yeast strain, it is important, but you've got to make sure or realize that it's of similar importance to the supply of the wort that it's being fed, because they're interacting, and they're both important. The other thing, Brad, I would say is this, in case I don't get to mention it, is that, there's a lot of, naughty is not the right word, but let's be honest about what happens in some places. Not too long ago, a year or so ago, I was in a brewery, and most people, when they go to breweries, they have the tour, and then they drink the beer. I prefer to do it the other way around, so I was sampling the beer, and then I had the tour. And I was taking a small sample and drinking the range of beers, a range of ales, and a range of lagers. And I then did the tour, and I said halfway through, so how many yeast strains do you have? And the brewer said, just the one.
Just the one. Just the one.
Just the one. And I she looked at me and she said, yeah, our lager is really a Kölsch, isn't it? That also illustrates the point that there's, you can be hard and fast and very religious, you might say, about the yeast strain, but and this differentiation between ale and lager, but it's sometimes the edges get blurred. Yeah. But of course, the other important thing about yeast strains is they differ in their flocculation characteristics.
And gravity too, right? Or,
yeah.
Attenuation.
Yeah. Yeah. So you do need to, all joking apart, you do need to understand your yeast strain. You need to know about its flocculation characteristics, because if you've got something that flocculates out prematurely, then yeah, it's not going to attenuate properly. Mm-hmm. And if you've got something that doesn't flocculate and it doesn't settle out very easily, then you've got a clarification issue. Now, I realize in the current time that, you know, a lack of flocculation might for some people be considered a very good thing. But the thing is, you have to be able to understand what it is and understand your yeast strain so that you can handle it properly. And again, it's not only about the yeast. In the case of flocculation, it's very dependent on the calcium content of the wort. And if you don't keep that consistent, you're going to change the flocculation behavior of the yeast. So.
Yeah. One of the nice things, though, is homebrewers have access now to all kinds of information on the yeast that we didn't have before. They run tests on them, and you can get a detailed data on the off flavors and all those things. How do you go about trying to translate some of that stuff that you might read on a yeast data sheet into actually making this yeast selection for a particular style of beer?
Well, I personally believe that the best way to evaluate things is to try it, to basically suck it and see. Back in the day, when I was research manager with Bass, if we wanted to evaluate yeast strains, we would do them side by side in long tubes. Actually, I think they were called Carlsberg tubes, but they were long tubes which mimic the sort of the pressure effect, the sort of the hydrostatic pressure that they would get in the fermenter, and we would literally take the same wort and compare different yeasts side by side and to see which one maybe gave the result we liked the best. So I think to my mind, and I'm sure Chris White and other people will forgive me for saying this, I think there's everything to be said, and they probably like me to say this, is to get several strains and try them out for yourself side by side and see, you know, which ones give you the result you're looking for. There's lots of different ways, Brad, to get yeast. An old boss of mine stole some yeast one time from the top of a fermenter. He walked in and very surreptitiously slid his handkerchief across the top of the fermenter and put it in his pocket and came back and said, isolate what you can from that. So I'm hoping it was a clean handkerchief, but otherwise the source of the yeast might not have been what he said it was. But we actually did use that, and we actually used that to make a very successful beer. But so theft is a great way to actually get hold of yeast. But there's a lot of I think trial and error, and I don't, you know, and again, I think it's because a given yeast is capable of giving you a different beer depending on the wort and the oxygenation conditions and the
That was actually the next question I had, which is, you know, how do you deal with all the variability that comes in? Let's say you get a pure yeast strain and it's come from a pure source and you know what the yeast is. How do you deal with variability in the actual fermentation? I mean, the thing's a living organism, and
yeah, it is. But you know, what we talk about is fermentation control. So if you really, you know, the way, one of the stages in getting a consistent beer, and as I repeatedly say, the idea of quality is the beer you want every time, and clearly the fermentation is a critical stage in achieving consistency. So we speak of fermentation control. That means you've got to define the fermenter you're using and how much liquid is in that fermenter. You've got to specify the wort. And if you think about it, that is potentially one of the biggest variables, because if you're growing a microorganism in a laboratory, you're doing research, like I was a biochemistry PhD student, you define the word. You put in so much of the carbon source, you put in a specific amount of a specific nitrogen source, and you put in a, all of the things you, you wanted, and you could define it very carefully. When you got wort, basically what you've got is an extract of malt, and that malt, you know, will show a degree of variability and so on. So, so the wort itself is probably at least as big a variable as anything else. And of course, you, you specify it on the basis of its of the malt you use or the grist you use to make it, on the basis of the mashing temperature, and so on and so forth.
But of course, so, the malt and the hops have variation from season to season, right?
Absolutely right. So you, you you've got to. You know, you've got to narrow it down and make it as consistent as you possibly can. So you, you'll define the gravity, you'll define the amino acid composition, the FAN level, and these sorts of things. So you've got to keep that constant. You've got to control the oxygen level that you give, because the different oxygen levels will give you different extents of yeast growth and the production of certain volatiles. For example, if you have too much oxygen, you'll produce less esters. You've got to control the your zinc, because if there's anything that's likely to be limiting, it's zinc. So you want to make sure you've got enough zinc in there. Zinc's getting a good press at the moment in the coronavirus type thing as well, by the way. So you control all the variables, and you, of course, you've got to control the how much yeast you put in. And the health of that yeast. So you've got to put in a certain quantity, a specific quantity of living yeast, viable yeast, and healthy yeast. The best way to make sure it's healthy is to look after it. Right. And the last thing that a lot of people don't think about is how bright that wort is, how clear, what's the clarity of that wort?
Why does that matter?
The German tradition, and if you think you talk to any German brewer, they're looking for what is called bright wort. They're looking to make sure that the break, the trube, hot break, cold break, are removed before fermentation. Other people say, no, it's a good idea to have particles in there, turbidity in there, for this reason. When the yeast is fermenting, it's producing carbon dioxide. And if there's particles present, let's say cold break particles, that causes the carbon dioxide to come out of solution as bubbles. And those bubbles rise. And when they rise, they take the yeast with them. So the yeast, if you've got what we call a dirty wort, the yeast is moving around in that fermenter, making much better contact, and therefore you're getting a more vigorous fermentation. Now, the point is that the Germans say, no, you don't want that, because those particles have got lipids and fats on them, which is not good for quality. The important thing is you've got to make sure it's the same every time, the same degree of clarity. Because if sometimes you've got a bright wort and sometimes you've got a cloudy wort, that will change the fermentation performance. You won't have fermentation control.
Is there anything a brewer can do to try and control that or try and limit that?
Well, I mean, if you don't want the particles there, there's ways and means of clarifying. You can filter, or you can allow it. You can have a flotation device and settle it out. Probably on a small scale, not so simple.
Finings, maybe, I don't know. Findings.
Yeah, yeah, but you've got to do it. So obviously, it means when you're making the work, getting rid of the hot break efficiently in a whirlpool operation or a hot back or something like that. And in the cold break, that's the bigger challenge, because you're producing that when you cool the wort. And unless you've got a centrifuge or a filter or some sort of settling system that allows you to remove that break, not easy. Therefore, I would err on the side of making sure that you've got particles there and you've got that cold break in there. Because I think from a quality perspective, I think it's overplayed. I think from the point of view of encouraging fermentation, it's a good thing. And how do you know you've got to control fermentation? Well, of course, as everybody knows, you monitor that fermentation and with specific gravity drop, with hydrometer or whatever you use. And a controlled fermentation is one that has exactly the same pattern of gravity decline. So in other words, if you plot specific gravity over time through fermentation, if you've got the same plot, the same diagram, the same shape of curve as a specific gravity drops every time, then you've got a controlled fermentation. And I think it's key to achieving a consistent beer at the end of fermentation.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, a lot of homebrewers have access to that kind of thing now with some of these new electronic hydrometers and things like that. Yeah. So you can do that very easily, actually.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, we touched on this earlier, but let's talk about reusing yeast after you've used it once for fermentation. Can you use it again? How many times can you use it again? Is it getting contaminated as we use it? What are some of the concerns there?
Well, there is a risk of contamination, obviously. Hopefully, if you've got fairly good sanitary conditions, that risk is minimized. There are some brewers that, on a larger scale, commercial scale, will actually wash the yeast with acid. So it's called acid washing. And what they do is take the yeast, recover it, put it in a tank in a slurry, and they add acid, take the pH down to 2.2.
Wow.
They make sure it's very nicely mixed to make sure there's no hot spots, if you like. So it's 2.2. It's got to be cold. It's got to be about... refrigerated temperature, 0-4 degrees Celsius, 2 hours, and then they pitch it straight away. You don't try and neutralize it, and you don't let it linger longer than a couple of hours, and then they pitch it in, and that kills off bacteria. It won't kill off yeasts, but it will certainly minimize any bacterial contamination. However,
it's the low pH that's killing it, probably.
It is. It's the acid that's killing the mice. Yeah. Now, I don't recommend that on anything other than a commercial scale.
Yeah. But how can what can a homebrewer do?
Well, a homebrewer just makes sure everything's hygienic. I mean, you use it hygienic, or you use one trip yeast. I guess we can come back to that later on, where you only use it once. You don't try and recover. Now, if you are going to reuse yeast, the one of the points is this: you got to make sure it's healthy, and if the yeast has been used for to make a beer that is quite alcoholic, then you can't use that yeast again. Yeast will become too stressed by higher alcohol contents. But if you're down in the 4, 5, even 6% ABV range, then the yeast should be capable of going to another fermentation, and it can be harvested and used. But again, either it's used immediately. Or if you are going to store it, it's a case of storing it under hygienic conditions.
And how do you recommend, let's say we do want to store, homemade yeast, or not homemade yeast, but homebrewed yeast?
You need to store it such that you're not going to... Well, let me tell you how it's done on a commercial scale, and you can scale it down. But what they will do is they put it into something like a yeast brink, a tank, and it will be gently stirred to make sure that you're not getting an accumulation of yeast, and it will be regulated in terms of temperature, so it's not going to be building up temperature. So I recommend that you collect your yeast and store it cold, basically, but not for too long. So you harvest your yeast by settling or skimming or whatever it is on your system, and then store it cold.
Mm-hmm. Some people typically in a fridge, right?
Yeah. Some people, but not for too long. It's easiest if it's done fresh.
So what's what would too long look like? Can I store it for weeks or?
Yeah, I would err on the side of days rather than weeks.
Okay.
And
then I assume you want to build a starter up from that probably again, and then pitch it, right?
I'll give you an example. But at the brewery where I was a QA manager, we used to do something called cone-to-cone pitching. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about there are these cylinder conical fermenters, very large ones, 2,000 barrels of UK barrels, so 1.6 hectolitres. Literally at the end of fermentation, you apply the chilling, the yeast settles down to the cone, And literally, you pump the yeast from one cone to a cone of the new wort in a separate vessel. So there was basically no holding time whatsoever. So yeah, so there's and certainly no no propagation, no pre-growth or anything like that. It was cone to cone pitching. Mm. Now to your question, how many?
Yeah, how many times?
I personally am not a fan of double figures. I think I'm able to say this. The Bass absolute limit was 15 generations, but we tried usually to be within the sort of the 8 to 10 maximum range. It was only in a bit of a peculiar scenario where we got as high as 15. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that, you know, as you go on, yeast becomes more and more stressed. And there are a number of stresses on yeast. And one is the osmotic pressure from the sugars. One is alcohol. And when yeast gets stressed, the two things can happen. One is it can autolyze. In other words, it can rot. It can fall apart. But the other thing is it tends to release some proteins, and it releases an enzyme, a proteinase, which chews up the foaming proteins. So it damages the head. And, you know, as everybody knows, I'm very partial to a good head on beer.
The purple foam.
Yeah, something like that. So I don't encourage people storing using the yeast too many times, because progressively you are, unless you're very selective, and you can be selective under certain circumstances, unless you're selective about what you're harvesting, you are progressively going to be having a population which is that much older. Mm-hmm. When I say selective, if you have got a cylindrical conical vessel with a conical bottom, you find that the trube settles out to the bottom mostly, and then you've got the older yeast, which is the next layer, and then on top of that, you've got the sort of the more mature yeast, and then right at the top, you've got the young yeast. And so you can actually, if you know what you're doing, you can harvest the preferred population of yeast cells. But, you know, on a homebrew scale, it's...
Well, surprisingly, a lot of us have conicals now. So it is possible to do that. Well,
it's worth experimenting with what you can do.
So maybe draw the yeast off
the middle portion,
near the end,
yeah.
Or the middle, yeah. Middle of fermentation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not certain saying that necessarily. Well, yes, you could totally.
Because on mine, I can draw it. You know, anytime I can pull a lot of the grain out right up front, and then you know you get more and more yeast towards you get towards the end.
Yeah. Absolutely. So. You got to remember, as I think I've said before, I've never been a home brewer, so I'm not. Yeah, what wonderful things you guys are capable of doing these days. So,
Well, a lot of the equipment's it has gotten cheaper, and people now are able to, you know. I mean, it's not super common, but you can get conical fermenters are fairly common now, surprisingly. So,
I was given a talk, Brad, in Cornwall, where my wife is from, 3 or 4 years ago. And I was talking about foam, and I was talking about not using old yeast. And this chap said, "How many generations do you recommend?" I said, "No more than 10. He said, "Well, the last count, we were 4,676.
That's a few beers.
And I said, "Just go for it. You'll be
okay." Well, that brings us to wild yeast. How's wild yeast different than cultured brewer's yeast?
Well, you've got to first of all define what a wild yeast is. I mean, wild yeast is basically any yeast. It's not the one you think you should have there. So there used to be a brewery in the south of England at Reading. It was a Courage brewery, and they produced a number of beers under a franchise. So they produced Miller, and they produced Foster's. And I think they produce Kronenbourg. And so basically, if they ever, I'm not sure they ever did, but if they ever got the Kronenbourg yeast into the Miller, then that's a wild yeast, and vice versa. So a wild yeast is anything that ain't the one you think. But when people talk about wild yeast, then obviously there's a bunch of different yeasts, including one I mentioned earlier on, Saccharomyces diastaticus. The issue, as the name would suggest, with diastaticus, apart from the fact that it makes the clovey flavor, the second is that it's got extra enzyme activities that will actually super attenuate the beer. In other words, it will deal with the dextrins and convert those into fermentable carbohydrates, so you get an over attenuated product. Then, again, another yeast that people certainly don't want to have around unless they're making funky beers is Brettanomyces.
Yeah, Brettanomyces is not a yeast, right?
Well, no, it's an organism that is classified alongside these because it's certainly not a bacterium. So it's in the population of organisms that so it's not a primary brewing yeast, but the history is fascinating. Mm-hmm. When Emil Christian Hansen in Carlsberg came up with pure yeast culture technology back in the late 19th century. Before that, of course, people used to use whatever yeast is was developed in their breweries, and so they had the house character from the yeast or yeasts, whatever was growing there. And of course, when they were going fermentation to fermentation, then that could be a variable beast, as it were. Hansen diluted yeast to a single cell, and then he multiplied all of the daughter cells from that single cell of brewing yeast, and therefore he had pure yeast. And this went all over the world except the British. The British did not like this idea. They insisted they needed two different types of organism. The first is they needed Saccharomyces for the primary fermentation, and then they needed a second one from a different genus or whatever the word is that could condition the beer to mature the beer. And in honor of the British, they called it Brettanomyces. I mean, the myces is the clue. So these are fungi, but not Saccharomyces. So Brettanomyces. And of course, different strains will give you different characteristics, but some of them, more than others, will give you a pronounced barnyard character. So wet horse blanket, mouse pee, these sorts of characters. So
lovely.
People often say to me, how do I get an authentic English IPA? I say, well, you better start getting some Brettanomyces. So Brettanomyces is clearly a feature in a number of what my friend Vinnie Chilezo calls funky beers. I often tell the story, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but Vinny will tell us if it's true or not, that, you know, when winemakers in Napa see Vinny walking down the road, they cross over so they don't have to shake his hand because they don't want Brettanomyces. But if you get Brett loose, if it gets loose, then it's a hell of a thing to deal with in your brewery. But Vinny Chilezo and Russian River, they're very, very good at their practices.
Yeah.
Everything is color coded. So, to the best of my knowledge, they've never had an issue with it. But they make their Plinies and they make their funky beers in the same facility.
Right. You've been working on it with a new yeast called, I got to help me out here, La Chancia. Is that right?
La Chancia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Chancia is another organism. I honestly can't tell you huge amounts about it other than what we did. It's an organism. This was a master student of mine called Jen House. This is an organism that attenuates wort, but it also produces more acid. It drops the pH. So here we have, rather than having a sort of a mixed population, here is an organism that will actually ferment the beer and also acidify it at the same time.
I think I've heard a little bit about this. So this is essentially a yeast that also produces lactic acid, right?
So it's producing acid. It's also attenuating your wort. So you basically have all of your, if you're making a sour beer, you have all of your activities in a single organism. And of course, that is extremely convenient if you want to achieve control, because one of the great challenges of making some of the funky beers is you've got a mixed population. And how are you going to do that? Are you going to do that by trying to have a defined population and control that population? Or are you literally going to let nature take hold and have that house character and have whatever is populating the brewery and naturally seeding the operation.
So, right, much different than today where we have to use both, right? We have to use our traditional yeast and Brettanomyces in combination, right?
Right. Yeah. So here is just a solitary organism. So this came pretty much at the end of my career as a research scientist at UC Davis, very much driven by the enthusiasms of Jen House, who really wanted to work on this, and she screened a lot of organisms, hopefully somebody will carry on this work. She's brewing up in Oregon these days.
Well, I think some people are already starting to experiment with it, because I've heard from other guests about this variation of yeast or these new yeast strains that have these characteristics. I guess that's right. Interesting. Yeah, well, Charlie, we're actually coming up near the end, but I wanted to maybe hear your closing thoughts on yeast and some of the takeaways for brewers.
Yeah, it's often when I talk about how people set up a quality operation in a brewery, I talk about all the things they need to do. And one of the lines I always throw out is treat the yeast like one of the family. I mean, respect your yeast. It's a living organism. Your malt was a living organism, but it's dead by the time you've got it. And the yeast is alive and kicking, and it needs to be healthy. If you are going to make the most of it. So people talk about all sorts of fancy tests. People talk about vitality tests. You know, how can you measure the vitality of a yeast? If you define vitality, people say, well, what is vitality? I say, well, look at me and look at your favorite baseball player or something, and one of us is fit for pitching, if you pardon the pun. And that wouldn't be me, although we're both viable.
You're more of a soccer goalie, if I recall, right?
I was, yeah, yeah. Back in the day. That was a long time ago. And cricket and rugby as well. But anyway, so there's 1,001 different ways to measure vitality, which means that none of them are any damn good. So, but you've got to look after it. So know what your yeast is. Try to keep it as pure as you can by good practices, good hygienic practices. And if you are going to store it between fermentations, then, as we've said, alluded to, look after it and treat it well. Which brings me to just one thing we didn't talk about, and that is the concept of using one-trip yeast, using yeast one time. The wine guys have been interested in dried yeast for a long time, and brewers increasingly are interested in dried yeast. The yeast connoisseurs that I know prefer liquid yeast. Mm-hmm.
Dry yeast has kind of a bad reputation because early on we used to get like bread yeast and all kinds of ridiculous ingredients. But
yeah, I think it's come a long way.
It has.
If for sheer convenience sake, and for yeast handling and putting the onus on looking after the yeast, treating it like one of the family, with dried yeast, you're much more putting the onus on the yeast supplier, than you are otherwise. And of course you can buy liquid yeast as well. So, for a lot of people, it will be more convenient to take the single one-trip yeast approach. But if you're passionate about doing things and taking advantage of the extra yeast you produce during fermentation, then as long as you're treating that yeast with complete respect, then it will serve you well.
Well, Charlie, again, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to come on today. It's great having you as a guest.
My pleasure. I'm surprised you've not got tired of me yet. But,
never get tired of you. You're one of my favorite guests. I've said that many times, I think, haven't I? I think I have.
Yeah, you
are. I lost count. I think this is like your ninth or tenth time on the show, maybe, or something like that.
You probably say that to everybody.
No. Today, my guest was Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Brewing Science at the University of California, Davis. Thank you again, Charlie. Well, a big thank you to Dr. Charlie Bamforth for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass. With access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To get yours, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.